It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, the amazing brain. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around the future of the human brain. Augmented intelligence, memory playback systems, downloadable skill sets. If you think computers are powerful, just wait until science starts hacking the brain.
Can you imagine one day having a brain net where the internet is replaced by a brain net where we send memories, emotions, and feelings on the internet?
Today, we'll get a glimpse of new brain technologies that are already on the drawing board. Of course, the human brain is already one of the most malleable, resilient systems in the universe. For example, Jason Paget has what neurologists call acquired savant syndrome. A traumatic brain injury turned him into a math genius. Every day, in the most ordinary daily activities, running water in the sink, making coffee, he sees mathematically. He describes it in his memoir, Struck by Genius.
Imagine, like, when everything moves, instead of it looking smooth, it looks like individual, like, discrete picture frames coming in. So it's kind of like hitting pause on your TV and watching frame by frame, but in real time. And it's so geometric. It's just absolutely amazing. Or watching water go down the drain, any type of spiral, is instead of looking like it's this smooth spiral like it used to look like, it looks like these little straight tangent lines around the edge, which is like a recursive form of the Pythagorean theorem. It's like taking a squared plus b squared equals c, but then you re-input c as a in the next little triangle, and b, say, for instance, always equals 1, and that creates one type of spiral. And how those numbers vary make it spiral, you know, faster or spiral out longer, you know, that type of thing.
So that's what you see just when you're
constantly
turning on the water in the sink?
Everywhere. Yeah, it's constant. And it never turns off. And it's beautiful.
Jason, you weren't born with the ability to see the world mathematically.
Can you
describe what happened?
Yeah, I was at a little karaoke bar and had some friends there. And I went there and I sang a song. And then I ordered a Coke and then I paid for the Coke. And there was two other guys that were singing karaoke there. And as we left, they left behind us. And I just wasn't paying any attention to them. And they attacked me from behind. I didn't see it coming. I just saw this bright flash of white light and felt this, you know, really deep thud. And the next thing I knew was I was on my knees trying to figure out, why am I on my knees? Where am I? What's going on? Why am I getting hit from all these different directions? And I remember thinking, I'm going to die right now. And that fight or flight kicked in. And then I had this feeling of, I just want to hurt one of these guys before I die. And I grabbed one of their legs and I bit him on the leg so hard that it actually cracked my front teeth and pulled him down on the ground. And then the other guy that was behind me just started hitting me in the back of the head and kicking me in the back of the head and in the back. And they hadn't said anything. And this had been going on for like a minute. And I even looked up at people and said, help. And then I said, gosh, you know, darn it. Only some other words, help. And not one person did anything. One guy just took his hands, like put them up in the air and said, uh-uh, and then turned around and walked away. And so that part was really hard because nobody helped. And then finally one of them said, give me your jacket. And I threw my jacket off, jumped off his friend. They grabbed it and they ran away.
Wow. And at what point in your recovery did you realize that your perception had changed?
It was very soon, right afterwards. In fact, there was a hospital right across the street. I went there, and they said, you have, you know, profound concussion and a bleeding kidney, and they gave me pain medicine, sent me home. And I remember thinking, this pain medicine is just wild stuff because everything looks so weird. But then, you know, the next day, the pain medicine had completely worn off, and then I knew that something for sure was up with me.
Uh-huh.
These other bad things came with it. Like, it was very just traumatic. I didn't realize it was post-traumatic stress, but I mean, I literally holed up in my house for almost 3 years. I would leave basically just to get food. Some other things came with it too, like OCD. Never had OCD. And then suddenly being so aware of everything, it's like constantly being aware of so much coming in that you start noticing, oh, that guy just touched his nose and then he just grabbed a doorknob and now he wants to shake my hand. And you're noticing all this, and when you start noticing that, there's germs everywhere, so it creates this massive amount of anxiety, and it just gets worse and worse. It got so bad that I was, like, Lysoling my money and then putting it in the microwave for 30 seconds to, like, kill the germs on it, washing my hands till they bled, you know, almost. Eventually, I got some treatment for that to make it better. And then I get these uncontrolled muscle movements throughout my body to this day. That they just vibrate, like kind of feels like a cell phone vibrating.
So it's not some weird Cinderella story. You got attacked, you woke up, and hey, you're a genius.
Right.
There's some pretty bad parts, too.
Right.
What were you like before the injury?
Before, life was definitely shallow. It did have this kind of blissful ignorance to it, you know, because all I really did was just goof off, chase girls, go out to bars all the time.
You were a party guy. Total
party guy, just goof off, yeah. You know, that's how life went from like 16 to about 31, 32.
Did you like math?
No, I hated it. I was one of those kids that's like, when are you going to use this? And what does this apply to, you know? And I couldn't stand it. Had no interest in it. Really had no interest in school even. I copied a lot off my friends, that type of thing. Skipped
wow.
a lot of classes.
Wow. I mean, you wound up going to school and getting a degree in math. What was it like at first being in a math class? I mean, was it hard to translate for you between what you saw and what the math teacher would say?
Sometimes it was. I had a great teacher. What happened is I was at a Subway drawing, and I had a guy that was a physicist. He started talking to me and said, boy, what you're drawing there looks really mathematical. And he's like, what are you taking in school? And I was like, oh, I had pre-algebra in high school. And I had was just layman terms to describe it, which is, I think, the reason why some people like this is because it's easier for everybody to understand because it's not in these technical terms. And he said, well, boy, that's great, but to prove it, you really need to learn how to say things in equations. And he convinced me to go take algebra at just a community college. And I went, and right as soon as I got in there, they graphed an equation. And that was when I was like, wait a second, these equations are talking about geometry? Because I didn't even know you could graph an equation. And they were like, my teacher was like, yes. And I'm like, well, then we're talking about the same thing. I'm just doing, you know, math in its natural form, which is geometry, and you're doing it in this form, which can prove it.
There's this other gorgeous phrase in the book. You said that you describe this as seeing the mathematical grace of the universe.
Literally. I mean, for instance, like f of the x equals x squared makes if you graph that in math, right, it makes a little parabola, like a U shape, you know, opening upwards. And if we do negative x squared, it turns that up. And when you put a negative in front of equation, it takes the shape that it's describing and just flips it upside down, makes a reflection of it. And so when you throw a ball in the air, it makes this little parabolic curve. You know, we use equations to describe the geometry of what's going on in the universe. But what's real, x squared or the parabola? And it's the parabola that's real. And no matter what we're doing in math, we're always describing geometry. And literally, there is nothing that doesn't have geometry. Even empty space, nothing is geometry.
You know, I've heard people say, mathematicians or physicists, that the universe is made of math.
Mm-hmm.
I never really got it until now.
Until you think of it as geometry. And what's so cool is geometry is the one thing that everything has. I always ask teachers, come up with something that doesn't have geometry. And they can't. Even thought is a brainwave. Even empty space is geometry. In fact, it's the one thing that you need nothing to have. Absolutely nothing is geometry, and geometry is equations. So by having nothing, you have every equation in existence. Isn't that crazy? There's
yes.
no beginning. There's no end. It just is. It's
See,
the one thing that is.
Do you feel blissed out?
A lot of times, like we're driving, my daughter will be like, Dad, it's time to slow down, you know, because I'm looking at this cloud or this tree and just going, oh, man, can you see that? Or can you, wow, you know, or water, especially with light bouncing off of water, or if there's a rainbow. The rainbows are just awesome because literally that is pie.
Oh. Wow. What do you now think about the human mind because of what's happened to you? I mean, do you think this ability was dormant in you from the beginning and the injury just kind of woke it up?
I think there's a lot of things dormant in us that we don't even realize. Like if somebody throws you a ball and you catch it, you know, you calculated the gravitational field acceleration due to gravity, you know, how long it takes the signal to get from your brain to your fingers to close on the ball. If you were to crunch that as a math equation, it's a serious, serious, you know, equation, yet you just catch the ball. So we're always constantly doing serious math, and our brain just does it naturally.
So that almost makes it sound like maybe your brain slowed down enough to be able to see it. Yeah.
Yeah. There's more going on around us by far that we can't see or perceive in any way than what we really do see. I mean, right, like there's a trillion neutrinos shooting every square centimeter of us every second. And I mean, if you could see all the stuff going on, it would just look like a jumbled mess. So it's almost like our bodies have evolved to filter out all of these other things so that we can actually get something done.
Right. You know? I was going to say, it must be hard. I mean, it sounds a little overwhelming
to
be aware of it all the time.
It is. It would. There are times when I wish I could just turn it off because I want to just sleep or I just want to relax.
I'm curious, if somebody came to you, if I came to you and said, some neurologists have figured out what to change in my brain so that I could see the world the way you do,
mm-hmm.
would you suggest I go for it? Or would you say,
And have all the drawbacks? Even then, I would have to say, you know what? If you're willing for the drawbacks, if you're willing to take it, I wouldn't give it up. There's no way I would give it up. Absolutely not. Even though it's sometimes really annoying and these bad things have come with it, the good far outweighs the bad. Mm-hmm. So I would not give it up, and I would tell everybody else, go for it as long as you're willing to put up with the rest.
Thank you so much for talking. It was a pleasure.
You too. Thank you very much.
Jason Padgett's memoir is called Struck by Genius. So what if you didn't have to get hit on the head to become a genius? What if you could take a pill or download some netware that would supercharge your brain? Hollywood loves that story, but so do a few real scientists. Theoretical physicist Michio Kaku has just written a book called The Future of the Mind. He told Steve Paulson we're in a golden age of brain science.
Think 10, 15 years ago when the brain was largely a black box. Now, however, using MRI scans, we can see down to about a tenth of a millimeter. We can actually see thoughts ricocheting like a ping pong ball inside the brain. And so we've learned more about the brain in the last 10 years than in all of human history combined.
Now, one of the hottest fields in neuroscience is the brain-machine interface. What's happening here?
Oh, there's been an absolute explosion of this. For example, Stephen Hawking, my colleague, the famous cosmologist, has lost complete control of his fingers, so we physicists put a chip in his right glass, an antenna that connects him to a laptop computer, allowing him to communicate with the outside world. And if you put a chip directly on top of the brain, you can now control a laptop computer, which controls a wheelchair, household appliances, allows you to write email, send email, do crossword puzzles, play video games, operate the light switch. Anything you can do with a computer, these people can do with the mind.
You'll have to explain this. So going back to the example of Stephen Hawking, so he has this chip in the corner of his glasses. How does he actually use that to activate a computer?
Well, what happens is, commercially now, headbands are available. You don't have to put a chip in your glass, but headbands are available that pick up radio from the brain. The brain is a milliwatt transmitter. It's electrical. It emits a slight amount of electromagnetic radiation, which can be picked up by these headbands and by these chips. Then they're connected to a computer. And historically, we never knew how to unravel this mass of data coming from these sensors, but now we can. We can create a dictionary between certain impulses picked up by the headband and certain motions of the cursor on a computer screen.
Well, speaking of kind of these science fiction-like technologies, you talk about the possibility of new technology that will record our memories.
Yes, this was once considered totally preposterous. I mean, how can you record a memory after all? It's so fleeting. But at Wake Forest University in North Carolina and also in Los Angeles, they did it. You take a mouse and you put electrodes on the hippocampus, which is the gateway to memory. By recording the messages, they can then replay these messages months later, and you remember tasks that you had forgotten. So they trained the mouse to sip water. They recorded the memory on the hippocampus, replayed the memory months later, and bingo, the mouse remembered on the first try.
How do you record a memory?
Well, you record a memory very simply by tape recording the impulses going from the left to the right part of the hippocampus. We have no way of decoding this. In other words, we're actually clueless as to how to decipher this tape recording, but you don't have to know. And next will come primate trials. For example, a monkey may eat a banana or something like that. And after that, the short-term goal is to create a brain pacemaker, such that you push a button and you immediately know where you live, who you are, for Alzheimer's patients. Think of it. There are going to be tens of millions of people around the world with Alzheimer's wandering our streets, not knowing where they live, who they are. They'll be able to push a button and retrieve many of these memories. And beyond that, perhaps even complex memories can be encoded, meaning that perhaps workers will be able to learn high-tech skills rather than having to go back to college to retrain themselves after they've been fired from their old job, which has been replaced by technology.
Well, it raises a question of what kinds of memories you would be able to record. I mean, is it sort of information, for instance, where you live? Or can you actually record more personal kinds of memories going back to childhood?
Well, here's an example of recording a vacation that you never had. Let's say that a test subject takes a vacation and has a luxurious walk on this beautiful, shiny beach. You can record that memory, that little snippet of memory of being right in the middle of this tremendous white beach and seeing the ocean, tape record that memory, record it on tape, and then play it back into someone else's hippocampus, and they too will have a memory of walking on the beach.
But I have to say, some of what you've been describing makes me a little nervous. I mean, the idea, for instance, of uploading memories into someone else's brain, I mean, that they never had, this really is right out of science fiction in a dystopian kind of way, I would think.
Well, it opens up a tremendous avenue of research, also entertainment. Can you imagine one day having a brain net where the internet is replaced by a brain net where we send memories, emotions, and feelings on the internet? Children would love it. Can you imagine Facebook? It would explode with memories of the first date, the first kiss, the first senior prom, things like that. But as you correctly pointed out, technology is a sword. It can be used to cut against ignorance, poverty, and disease, but it can also be used to cut against people. For example, at MIT just last year, they were able to upload the first false memory. False memories have now been uploaded into the brains of mice. And it means that in the future, perhaps the memory of a crime that you never committed could be uploaded into someone. And so this would probably have to be regulated. That is, memories in the future, I imagine, would have to be stated that clearly that this is a false memory. It's a memory of something that never happened. And you would have to have that information uploaded when the memory itself is uploaded.
Well, it also places tremendous power in the hands of the computer programmers. I mean, the people who are actually controlling this technology. Does this alarm you at all, some of these developments?
Well, first of all, we are genetically hardwired to be apprehensive about the future because our ancestors were timid apes. And so it's natural for us when we first hear about the internet, when we first hear about these technologies that are going to revolutionize our world, we're a little bit apprehensive. But then later, hey, we just get used to it.
Michio Kaku is a theoretical physicist at the City University of New York. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, The Future of the Mind. Coming up, the story of a world-class composer who lost the ability to write music and then learned how all over again. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you've been following To the Best of Our Knowledge the last few months, you know we're collaborating with Sipur Israeli, or Israel Story, the This American Life of Israel. It's one of the most popular radio shows in that country. In today's episode, Shai Satran brings us the story of an Israeli composer who lost her music after a traumatic brain injury and through hard work, got it back.
Hello, Shai.
Hi, Noah.
I met Noah Guy, an Israeli composer, in her Manhattan apartment.
Well, when people ask me how did you end up in New York, I always say by accident.
We'll get back to how and why Noah ended up in New York. But her story starts in her hometown, Jerusalem.
I was born in Jerusalem and grew up there. And from very, very early age was attracted to music and studied music.
The fact that Noah was so drawn to music was kind of surprising.
It's hard to say how Noah became so much into it.
This is Avnel, Noah's brother.
Our parents did not expose us to classical music.
Our father was injured in the Independence War and had always had headaches, so the house has to be quiet.
And a loud noise would disturb him a lot. And many times he would leave home just when Noah was playing, which was not very much encouraging. And in spite of that, she was very stubborn and continued to practice, to learn more.
So music was, in a way, sort of a noise. But nevertheless, I continued, and that was my passion. After high school, no question what I'm going to do. I went to the Jerusalem Music Academy, finished the theory department, and then studied composition privately, and then moved to Berlin to study music there.
After winning many international prizes, Noah moved back to Israel and was appointed to be the manager of the Jerusalem Music Academy, which, as you can imagine, is quite a big deal. And all in all, her career was booming.
And on 93, I came to work with Isaac Stern for a week.
Noah's week in New York was supposed to culminate with a concert at Carnegie Hall, a high point of any composer's career. The first few days of the week leading up to that concert were set aside for final rehearsals.
On that day, which was a Thursday, we went to his country house in Connecticut to work there in, you know, a different environment and quiet environment. I don't remember really much since. It was a country road. It was in the fall. Trees were burning colors, beautiful colors. Everything was a little like a dreamy, in a way. I do remember the last thing that I told Isaac, that I think that he's driving very, very fast. And he looked at me, you know, side look, and he used to call me Bubele. So I said, Bubele, don't worry, I'm a very good driver. That's the last thing I remember.
And on the way, he hit a tree and created a very severe injury to my sister. She just got out of the car, pulled him out, and then collapsed. She was evacuated to a New York hospital over there and was in a coma for quite a few days. And that came in a time that she was really getting into the peak of her career.
She woke up 8 days later.
The first thing that I remember is that I was violated, that something really awful happened. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know where I was alive or where I was dead. I was just seeing these half-white creatures hovering over me, touching me as if, you know, without asking permission. And it was an awful way to wake up. I couldn't make sense of anything. It's really tempting to give up at a situation like that. But it was a decision not to. I'm going to make it.
But she made two decisions. One, to stay in life. Second one was that she'll be okay and she'll be able to function as a normal person.
That second decision, to lead a normal life, would require tremendous efforts and many years.
I was paralyzed on the whole right side of the body. You know, I had shoulder injury, hip injury, all kinds of injuries, but the main thing was the brain injury.
She was then with one of the physicians. They just put a pencil in front of her and asked her, what is that? And she could not say the word. She could not identify. And then I burst in tears, and it was the first time for her to see me really crying.
It's not easy to explain, because after I got a little better and I was able to communicate and I began to live again, people didn't realize what really was going on, that for me to hear a sentence and remember the whole sentence and formulate an answer was an enormous task. And that's why I call this a transparent injury, because from the outside I looked fine. I was talking, I was nice, I was smiling, I was polite. And inside it was this struggle to go on, not to, you know, not to let the injury shut me down, and because it was so taxing.
When we talk to each other now and there's some background noise, we can ignore this noise. But she cannot. She has to process it through her mind and decide what she had constructed it. And that takes a lot of energy and very tiring.
What Avner just described is a malfunction of sorts of Noah's attention modification system. It can be explained through a famous psychological finding, the cocktail party effect. Imagine you're chatting with someone at a cocktail party. There are many different background noises. Loud music is playing, the sounds of silverware, plates, glasses clinking, not to mention all the other conversations taking place all around. But somehow, we sort of lower the volume on all those background sounds and raise it on our friend's voice. We don't have to think about it. We're not even conscious of it. It just happens. Basically, our brain is constantly filtering out a huge amount of stimuli that simply isn't that important to us. Without these filters, our brain would overload. What does it feel like to sit in a noisy restaurant and just have a conversation with a friend?
About half an hour after it begins, I have to leave because it's just bombarding me in a way that I'm so overwhelmed that at a certain point it's too much. You know, when you talk to me, you listen to me and you're not listening to the environment. And for me, all the sounds are at the same level. It's almost impossible to explain. It's as if I'm on a stage and there's floodlights all the time. There is nothing more important than the others. I can't filter out things because I lost the filters that we usually have of discerning what's important and what not. It's exhausting.
This condition of not being able to perceive or focus on more than a single object at a time has a name: simultagnosia. It's pretty rare, and most of the people who suffer from it, like Noah, experienced some sort of traumatic brain injury. But Noah's case is particularly interesting to researchers because her entire musical perception changed after the accident.
The first piece I wanted to listen to was Beethoven's String Quartet. And the first time I listened to it, I was blown away because I didn't hear a string quartet. I just heard four laser beams of sounds. They were very clear and totally disconnected. I couldn't make sense of it. I couldn't put it together. And I heard the violin, cello, viola, and I didn't know what it was. It was like four parallel independent lines that wouldn't connect. They were totally independent. It was like a piece of puzzle, you know, just scattered on the table. And you know that if you put them in the right pattern, they fit. I couldn't do that. I heard it, I don't know how many times. I heard it again and again in the hope that I will be able to put them together. Couldn't put it together.
Oliver Sacks, the famous neurologist, dedicated a chapter to Noah in his 2007 book, Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain. Sacks gave Noah's condition a name, disharmonia, the inability to integrate auditory components into a single harmony. Noah, of course, had devoted her life to music, and this was the worst injury she could imagine.
In a way, I think that if I would have lost a leg, it would have been easier for me. But the fact that I lost a major part of my identity, of my inner identity, and that I could not recreate it, is cruel and painful still today. At a certain point, you know, listening to it again and again, it became like a torture.
Despite her disharmonia, Noah discovered that with substantial efforts, she could still appreciate and even create music. For example, when Noah reads sheet music, she can, in a sense, still imagine the music, at least in her mind, even though she can't hear the music. It's confusing. Her road to recovery was long and full of hurdles.
Today I can put things together, but it's work. I have to do it consciously. It's not that I put a piece of music and I hear the music. No, now I'm hearing the string quartet, so listen to them together and I learned how to do that, but it's still a conscious process. It used to be like language. I wrote string quartets. I mean, it wasn't even a question. It was a pleasure, and it was my refuge.
Noa had to relearn even the most basic skills.
I bought a piano, and I couldn't play. And it was a shock. After trying and realizing that I'm not going to be able to do it alone, I swallowed my pride and started taking piano lessons. I had to learn the ear-eye-hand coordination. It was a sort of a gift because I realized how complicated piano playing is, but it was also very frustrating because I lost my ability to play. I lost this connection to music that I had. I could sit and write music like you write a letter. And it was so easy, and everything was so enjoyable and so fluent. And I think that's the major thing, that if you ask me if something didn't heal, this didn't heal. Everything else is fine.
Na was stubborn. She learned to play the piano again and eventually even went back to composing. In 2006, 13 years after that concert that should have been, Na finally got her New York City debut.
I made 3 big pieces, hour long each. Actually, it's a musical diary of my recovery. So the first piece is from darkness to waking up, just broken pieces that are somehow put together and in the end are making some sort of sense. And a friend of mine came afterwards and she said, I know you for so many years. It's the first time that I begin to understand what you're going through.
At the beginning of the piece, you remember, Na explained that she ended up in New York by accident, quite literally. What she didn't say is that she hasn't been back to Israel since that accident, over 20 years ago.
Since then, she cannot travel because all of her balance organs were destroyed, so she's stuck for life in New York City, which is not bad. There are worse places to be stuck at.
For a very long time, I thought that, well, another 6 months of therapy and I'll be back home. I always wanted to go home.
She didn't make it back home. She didn't see my father because he was sick and couldn't travel, and she couldn't travel, and he passed away quite a few years ago. She could not be at her daughter's wedding and things like that.
And it took many years of therapy and forgiving and accepting to realize, okay, I can't go back. Israel is still, you know, I'm Israeli, but it's not painful anymore. But it used to be a real longing to come home. It took a lot of work to realize that a new beginning is the right approach and not hanging on to the past, which is not available. I'm in a place that I don't think that I would have been here in this form, being able to look at things and see things and see the world in a way that I do, and in a topsy-turvy way, I'm grateful for it.
Our story comes from Shai Satram with Israel Story. You can listen to more Israel Story pieces on our website at ttbook.org. And if you like them, tune in to Israel Story's first season in English on the Vox Tablet podcast. And that wraps up our discussion about music and the brain. Coming up, it's the 4th of July season, and how about this year we do something different? Along with the fireworks and the parades and the flag waving, what if we all decided to take 15 minutes and read the Declaration of Independence? The whole thing. It's like a couple of pages long and amazingly relevant to life in America today. We'll talk about that after a quick break. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you.
And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
I'm Andrew Warnes. I'm a lecturer in the School of English at the University of Leeds, UK. My dangerous idea is, what if America is exceptional after all? Over the last few years, we've seen a powerful critique of what has come to be known as the logic of American exceptionalism. In the American humanities, it's now quite customary for papers or essays to adopt what's called a post-exceptionalist or a post-nationalist perspective, and to accept that the USA was never really a beacon or a city on a hill, was never really a special snowflake of a country, but that it's always acted, when you get down to it, just like any other empire. Once a dangerous idea in its own right, this debunking of the belief that America is special or especially democratic has allowed our scholarship to confront a number of unpalatable truths. It's been very powerful, and it's allowed a kind of critique of empire to unfold. But I'm starting to wonder whether the critique of American exceptionalism has begun to overreach itself. And I sometimes wonder whether scholars are a little too quick to drop the commitment to the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that are at the centre of the formation of the American state. America's a very exciting place politically. And one reason is that it seems to me that there is a kind of very powerful engagement by academics with grassroots organisations and different political movements right across the country. And that's something which is very invigorating. But I think that when those academics disavow a kind of language of patriotic dissent, of a language that I think has a kind of universal currency in American life of holding American power to its foundational promises, then demands become a lot more practical and a lot more difficult for those in power to rebut. And so I think it helps the cause of reform, and it could help organizations across, you know, academic and political boundaries to coalesce more meaningfully than perhaps they sometimes do at the moment.
A Dangerous Idea from Andrew Warnes. He's a lecturer at the University of Leeds in the UK. Every year, we celebrate the 4th of July because of a piece of paper, the Declaration of Independence, the founding document of this country. But have you ever actually read it? The whole thing, top to bottom? Because it's surprisingly relevant to a lot of the things that we argue about today, like income inequality, the 1%, racial justice. Political philosopher Danielle Allen teaches a class that's a really close reading of the Declaration of Independence, and her students have told her that doing this, just reading and thinking about the Declaration of Independence, has changed their lives. Steve Paulson wondered how that could be.
Danielle, my guess is that most people would say they have a basic understanding of what the Declaration of Independence is about, the founding document to some degree, announcing a new kind of American identity. But my sense is that you think we don't really understand it. Do I have that right?
You do. My basic take is that we haven't really taken the time to read its argument lately. It has a philosophically coherent argument about the ideal of equality, and that's what I've really been trying to recover and draw people's attention to.
Which I don't think is the usual take. I mean, I think most people would look at the Declaration of Independence, and I mean, this is a story about freedom above all. I mean, freedom from Great Britain, more so than about equality.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that it is about independence, but insofar as the text makes an argument, its argument is about equality. And that's a really important story because it explains why it is democracy is the right kind of political form.
Now, I would think in some ways, equality and liberty would kind of pull in opposite directions. I mean, equality is you're sort of trying to come up with some common rights, common access to resources for all people. Freedom kind of means you go off and do your own thing.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, in the last 50 years, we have really come to think of equality and freedom as pulling in opposite directions, as being, even in the language of some writers, in eternal conflict with each other. But actually, up until the early 1800s, the standard view was that equality and freedom reinforced each other, that you needed both to have either. I mean, there's a long historical story for why we've gotten to be bad at thinking about equality. And that story has to do with the challenges of thinking about economic issues in the wake of the Industrial Revolution and the massive disparities of income and wealth that accrue in the wake of the Industrial Revolution. When the founders wrote the Declaration, they didn't have the modern economy to think about. So we really face the question of trying to understand what are the egalitarian policies for running a market economy post-industrialization, post-globalization.
Can you take us through some of the passages in the Declaration of Independence? I mean, what are you looking at? I mean, what are sort of the key passages?
So if I tell somebody that I'm talking about equality in the Declaration, they'll say, oh, okay, well, I know you're talking about the second sentence, aren't you? You're talking about that glorious phrase where they say all men are created equal. And I am talking about that, but that's actually the second place equality comes into the Declaration. And we don't often notice that it comes in the very first sentence in a very different context. So in that opening, they say, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the bands connecting them to another and to assume the separate and equal station among nations that the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them to, then it's necessary for them to declare the causes that impel them to the separation. So what they're developing there is an ideal of equality as freedom from domination. They've acquired the capacity to govern themselves. They've built Continental Congress. They've built decision-making mechanisms. And so they're ready to say, keep out. Don't trespass. We've built a community here, and we'd like to be equal as a community. We're not as rich as Spain and Britain and France. We don't have anywhere nearly as strong as a military. We're talking about equality because we've got the political capacity to organize our own lives. And we are equal in that regard with the most powerful state on earth.
Is this sort of a different understanding of equality than we normally have?
I think that our muscles for talking about the ideal of equality have kind of atrophied lately, you know, in the last few decades. I think we're really good at talking about liberty and freedom. We have all kinds of ready-made or sort of stock phrases about that, you know, sort of, you know, things like a man's home is his castle, and we have a sort of idea of freedom associated with that.
And we don't want government to tell us what to do.
Bingo, exactly. You know, government is a threat to freedom and so forth. And we just so many ready-made and stock phrases. But what are our stock phrases about equality? We really don't have them anymore. And so I think the first thing you have to do actually is ask yourself the question, which kind of equality am I talking about? Am I talking about political equality or social equality or moral equality? Or am I trying to talk about something in the economic realm? And there, I think, you know, we're more likely to talk about justice or fairness or opportunity, right? But you have to really separate out those different egalitarian strands in order to even begin to know what you're talking about when you invoke the concept of equality.
You've taught this document, I know, in various places. I mean, you've taught it at elite colleges, Princeton, Harvard, University of Chicago. You've also taught the Declaration of Independence to night school students.
Exactly.
In Chicago.
Yes.
Was that a very different experience?
It was completely different and truly wonderful. The difference between the night school students and the undergraduates is that the night school students already had a lot of life behind them, and it wasn't always a pretty picture. Hadn't been an easy thing. Their lives were full of difficulty in one way or another. You know, maybe they were working two jobs, or maybe they didn't have a job. It was a class that was specifically for people who were roughly at the poverty line. Lots of health issues, sort of relatives lost to gunfire or things like diabetes. So when they came to texts like the Declaration, they brought with it sort of passionate set of questions about their own efforts to change their lives. My undergraduates at all these terrific universities have also been, you know, splendid and wonderful to teach, but you know, for them in some sense, you sometimes feel a little bit more as if it's checking a box. You know, yes, I've read the Declaration of Independence, check, and I'll move on to the next thing, Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln. Whereas for the night students, they wanted to know, you know, how do I make my life better? How can this text help me make my life better?
And could it?
Absolutely.
Really? So how so?
So that is the brilliant thing about the Declaration, is its core argument is very simple. You know, human beings need to look around, diagnose their circumstances, figure out whether things are going well or badly for them. And if they're going badly, choose a course of action, come up with the reasons, justify it, and share that justification. And so my night students got the kernel of the Declaration a lot faster than any other students I've seen. What the Declaration offers is a certain kind of rigor of analysis. What's your diagnosis of your circumstances? What do you propose to do about it? How do you justify it? those three steps. And so I think they found it very empowering. You know, what was the different course they wanted to set? How would they justify it?
Really? So it actually had practical value.
That's right. And the practical value ranged from students who then felt empowered to even do things just like ask their boss for a raise, right? So, I mean, there's a whole range of ways in which empowerment matters. It doesn't have to be that you're sort of taking on, say, the whole system all at once. Sometimes it was deciding to make a change of residence. Sometimes it was a decision to leave a partner, actually, and to free oneself from a set of abusive relations in order to have a fresh starting point.
But you're saying some people actually came to the conclusion after talking about the Declaration of Independence in your class?
I'm not saying that, you know, the Declaration is the only part of that story, okay? And I would never want to claim something like that. But yes, I mean, I did have students come back to me and say, there was this big life decision that I was wrestling with, and reading the Declaration and thinking about it with you helped me clarify my choices.
Now, I would think some of your students would have said, you know, the main author of the Declaration, Thomas Jefferson, was a slaveholder. I mean, the founding fathers created a legal system that justified slavery, this oppressive institution. This history does not have anything to do with me. Or if it does, it was in a very bad way.
Well, that is exactly where most of my students started. So, I mean, you've put your finger on it. They were mostly poor people, mostly students of color. And they did connect it to sort of dead white male slave owners. So, I mean, it's a real question. How do you get past that? And that's where I think the Declaration is so profound as a text. I mean, because its story is most fundamentally about the effort of people to change their lives. Though having said that, it matters that the Declaration has anti-slavery voices in it as well as pro-slavery voices. We give Jefferson way too much credit for the Declaration.
He's not the sole author.
Not the sole author. It's part of a committee. He's, you know, brilliantly eloquent writer. And John Adams is the person who for the whole year had been working on the happiness concept, making the case for the happiness concept as the thing around which to organize our thinking about the purpose of government.
The unalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Exactly. That's not actually Jefferson, okay? And you can, you know, the easy way to see that is look at Adams' pamphlet from April of 1776 called Some Thoughts Concerning Government, where he makes the argument that the point of government, as with the point of individual lives, is happiness, the pursuit of happiness and achieving it.
So what does that mean, pursuit of happiness?
It's so important. It is so important. So first of all, remember, Adams is from Massachusetts. He's not a slaveholder. He never holds slaves in his life. He does not think slavery is a good thing. Okay, I'll come back in a minute to what happiness means. But first, we need to know the context in which he was introducing the concept. The Virginians have begun to use the more conventional term for thinking about your rights, property. And they've begun to use that term, property, to defend slavery. And when the Virginians in May of 1776 came to write their own constitution and George Mason wrote for them the Virginia Declaration of Rights, he produced a formulation of those core rights. It was life, liberty, property, and pursuing happiness. In other words, he accepted Adams' argument that he'd been making, but he kept the property term in there. So when we get to June and they're drafting the Declaration of Independence for everybody, that property term gets elbowed out. Hmm. That is an anti-slavery moment in the Declaration. And I really think we have John Adams to thank for that.
Now, if we try to put the Declaration of Independence in some historical context, was this a radically new document?
It was very radical. It's true sort of innovation. And this is when it's such a merger of Adams and Jefferson is in that famous second sentence. It's the incredibly long second sentence, which I'm always inflicting on everybody. So if you don't mind, here
we go.
Okay. So we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles, and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. It's that.
I'm impressed that you can just remember all that.
Well, I'm sure I've missed, mushed up some of the words here and there, but it's a theory of revolution. That's what's radical about the document.
And it's kind of radical to think about that.
It's
the founding document of our country, I mean, yes, of course, it led to the American Revolution. but it's a revolutionary document.
It's a theory of revolution.
I mean, exactly. You know, a theory of revolution in today's age when, you know, the powers that be don't want revolution.
No, exactly. I mean, that's the extraordinary thing about it. You know, think about founding your polity on a theory of revolution. It seems like a contradiction in terms. You mean, aren't you supposed to found it on something that's sort of like super stable and never going to change? But the whole point of the Declaration is that every generation has a responsibility to survey their circumstances and reconsider the question of what our principles are and how we make them real through institutional form.
Danielle Allen teaches political philosophy at Harvard, and she's the author of Our Declaration. Steve Paulson talked with her. That's it for our show today, but you can hear To the Best of Our Knowledge whenever and wherever you want when you subscribe to our free podcast. Just visit our website and we'll show you how. That's at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in downtown Madison. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Emma Roskowski. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.